As our state battles our country's worst coronavirus outbreak, you have aligned to the secretary designee of the Department of Health Services, DHS, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A 530-bed overflow hospital is set to open at the state fairgrounds. Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Hospital Association reports 950 COVID patients, 240 in ICU. As of last week, 85% of ICU beds are in use, according to DHS. Why is the virus spreading so fast in our state, and what can be done at this juncture? What do you want to ask about the administration's approach to managing the spread? We're at 800-642-1234. Secretary Andrea Palm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good to be back.
Well, there is this new record of hospitalizations this week. What can you tell us about this surge?
Yeah, we've been breaking records here with hospitalizations and new daily cases for a few days here now. As you mentioned, we sometimes have lower numbers coming out of the weekend as community testing sites, many of them are closed on either Saturday or Sunday, but we have seen the kind of almost exponential growth that we talked about in the spring as something we were really desperately working not to have happen, and it speaks to the need for us to all work together to do the things that we know help stop the spread: wear a mask, stay home as much as possible, limit your interactions with people who don't live in your household, the good hygiene. You know, the things we've been talking about now for months are the things we really need to get back to basics and do those things together.
Can you predict, are we anywhere near a peak?
Well, I think like that is the important thing about these interventions and in taking actions together, right? Our goal as a community, as a state, as a population needs to be to break the transmission cycle. And we do that by reducing the amount of contact we have with people outside our immediate household. And it is those actions collectively that will allow our peak to be sooner and lower, right? Because when you're talking about an incubation period, when you're talking about this virus, it takes a little bit to show up and then a little bit more to be severe enough if you get severe illness to require hospitalization. And so we need to do these things now so that 3 and 4 weeks from now we can come out the other side of it. But it is that collective action. We control our peak and when it happens and how high it is. And so we all need to do these things together to stop the spread.
Secretary, as you look at the spread around the state, it is spreading around the state, but there are these pockets like in the northeastern and central parts of the state where you have these higher concentrations. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is a combination of a number of things, right? It's maybe less adherence to mask wearing policies. Maybe it is the way communities in that part of the state are more connected. They're closer together. The workforce is more mobile in terms of you may live in one place and work in another jurisdiction and vice versa. The way those things all come together has meant we're seeing a spread that is more intense. I also think, right, one wedding, one retirement party, one outbreak that goes without vigilance, and you start a spark.
One super spreader event can just snowball.
Yeah, for sure. And so again, I think we all believe that our friends and our family are being careful. But the best thing we can do is to minimize our contact with people outside our household in a really vigilant way. Because one case in a nursing home can really be traumatic for that location, and they're very vulnerable. And so we need to do everything we can.
We're talking with DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm, breaking down the latest efforts to stop the massive spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. Have you or a loved one been sick with COVID? What was your experience like? Do you need medical care? And if so, were you able to access it? Do you work in the healthcare profession? What are you seeing at your hospital or clinic? 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's bring in David joining us from Wazika. Hi, David.
Good morning. I have a question. I do have a brother who is currently hospitalized and being treated with COVID and seems to be getting good care. He's in a Madison hospital. My question for the secretary is, you know, the governor it keeps emphasizing that we need to follow the science, and I'm just curious what the administration's reaction is to the World Health Organization coming out yesterday and saying shutting down the economy is actually worse than the pandemic itself, and how does that affect your judgments going forward about, you know, curbing economic activity? And I'll hang up and listen to my response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David, and speedy recovery for your brother. I'm glad to hear you feel like he is well taken care of. I would say I have not heard the World Health Organization's comments directly, but I would say that there is an important balance, right? What we know about the stressors from economic hardship, as you know, as well as the stressors from isolation and the anxiety, the behavioral health impacts of this pandemic, as well as the economic, are real. And there is an important balance to be struck there. I think one of the things that the governor has done as part of this response is to use the CARES Act dollars to try to relieve some of those and strike of that kind of balance about needing to do everything we can to do what we have to do to stop the spread of this virus on the scientific side, the staying home, the masking, the good hygiene, the reductions in capacity for public gatherings. Those are all things that the science tells us help stop the spread. But at the same time, you know, he has invested $125 million in business relief. He's invested money in renter's assistance, in food assistance, in other vehicles to try to mitigate against some of those economic issues. I think certainly Wisconsin needs more money to do those kinds of things, as does the country, considering that the federal dollars we have received expire at the end of the year. And we all need to work together to help the federal our federal partners, Congress, understand that without that money, not only can we not continue to test and trace and do the public health part of the response, but we also don't have money to do additional economic and business relief, food assistance, rental assistance, the other kinds of things that help relieve some of the pressure.
Do you mean that
pressure that our families are feeling?
Do you mean that state coffers couldn't cover those types of things?
That's correct. That's certainly correct. And our testing budget, you know, is well over $700 million here in the last 6 months. Because when you're testing, when you have the kind of capacity we have and the kind of infrastructure we have built, it's a lot of money to test and trace the kind of cases we're seeing right now.
Nearly 1.7 million people in Wisconsin tested to date. We have DHS Secretary Andrea Palm taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Department of Health Services Secretary Designee Andrea Palm on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A 530-bed field hospital is set to open at the state fairgrounds to expand care for COVID patients, as hospitalizations are now at 950 patients. Some hospitals around the state are saying they're maxed out. They're dealing with staffing shortages. What do you want to ask about the emergency order number 3, about masks? How has COVID touched your life? Conversation is at 800-642-1234. And DHS Secretary Andrea Palm stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Anne now in Milwaukee. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Hope you're having a good morning.
You too. Go ahead.
My question is, when the president contracted COVID, he was treated immediately for his symptoms, and he recovered rather quickly, as is obvious. Why is the average public not being treated in that manner instead of waiting until they're so sick they need to be hospitalized?
Anne, thank you. Secretary Palm.
Yeah, Anne, I think it is the reason why folks need to be in close and quick touch with their healthcare providers once they've been tested and are isolating. And they receive the result of that test. I think particularly for those who are vulnerable to more severe illness, those who have underlying health conditions, those who have circumstances that might make the illness more impactful on their health, need to be in close coordination with their doctor to make sure that they are getting treatment as soon as it is necessary and warranted, and that they are taking the guidance from their healthcare provider to do that in the most effective way possible. Everybody's a little bit different, and so it is really important that we are connected and talking with our healthcare providers as we navigate this. Should we get that positive test result and suffer symptoms?
Can you take us to the 530-bed field hospital that is set to open? What are the details there?
Sure. So as you mentioned, 530 beds, about 200 of them have the capacity to do inline oxygen, right? That's one of the things we know about this illness, is that those who are hospitalized often need oxygen. And so many of our beds have that capacity. This is a lower care facility. It is designed to provide backup to the hospitals across the state so that they are able to take care of those who suffer from more severe COVID illness, but also all the other illnesses that come walking into a hospital on a regular basis, strokes, heart attacks, car accidents, et cetera. And so our job is to be ready to take some of their lower acuity patients so that they can continue to execute on the mission and serve those who are more severely ill. We are scheduled to open Wednesday morning and are in very close contact with our hospitals about who might need to transfer a patient on opening day. And we will continue to navigate through this together very closely with our hospital partners.
How will it be staffed?
So we have a number of staffing contracts. We certainly have a number of Wisconsin-based folks who are joining us. We hired a chief executive officer back in April, Deb Sandridge. She is a retired healthcare provider from Ascension Health, the Ascension Health System, and she has been leading the effort to unmothball, they like to say, the facility, right? We had it fully ready to go in the spring and did not need it and put it into sort of a resting phase. And so she is leading a team right now with a chief medical officer, a chief nursing officer, some pharmacists, a COO, you know, an operational person to stand it back up and bring staff to be ready to open on Wednesday morning. We will not open staffed for 500. We will open ready for about 50 patients and we'll scale from there as is necessary, using the contracts and staffing firms and other suppliers that we have to meet the need as this evolves over the coming weeks and months.
Let's bring in Rob now in Madison. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm on the road, but thank you for taking my call. I wanted to have the secretary please address the issue of convalescent therapy treatment with the antibody from the plasma of coronavirus survivors. If she could give us an update on that information. I don't know how useful it has been in providing recovery for people who wind up getting it, whether they're applying it currently or if it was just a clinical trial that failed. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Is this therapeutic treatment, convalescent plasma, still operating in our hospitals?
Yeah, Rob, this is a place that is a little outside my expertise. So what I would say is it is not a clinical trial that has failed. I think that's one thing I can certainly be clear about. And folks are continuing to use it and gather data and information about its effectiveness. And right, it has shown some promising results, but it is not an FDA approved treatment, and they will continue. That you know, doctors and scientists will continue to do work on it. That and other promising therapeutics to see what works best to treat patients with COVID-19.
We're talking with DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm. She's breaking down the latest efforts to stop the massive spread of COVID in Wisconsin. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Ben now, who is in Bad River. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know in our little community here, numbers are deemed, I guess by the public are pretty important. I heard earlier a mention that 1.7 million people had been tested in Wisconsin. My question is that 1.7 million tests or is that individuals? Because, like, I know I've been tested more than once. So am I counted multiple times in that 1.7 or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. We display that information on our website both as unique individuals and as total people tested. That 1.7 million figure, let me see, as of, I'm just looking at my notes here so I don't get it wrong, we have administered in the state of Wisconsin almost 2.5 million tests. So that is total tests. So if you've gotten more than one test, you are in that 2.5 more than once. But we have tested over 1.5 unique individuals. So we display both sets of information on our website so that you have it, so that you can look at it, so that you can understand in context better total tests versus unique individuals.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about gatherings, the emergency rule number 3 that is currently under scrutiny in the legislature. What are you asking about indoor gatherings?
Yeah, so, you know, I think as we've seen the surge, as we've seen the numbers in September really escalate, as hospitals have started to feel the strain, as we've seen record numbers of hospitalizations of you know, large numbers of deaths day over day, it became really important as we were asking people to take action voluntarily to do the right thing to help us reflatten the curve. It became clear that we needed to take some additional steps to be part of that solution. So this public gatherings restriction limits indoor public gatherings to 25% of the capacity of the location. So it does impact bars, restaurants, retail, any place that is open and available to the public. But again, right, it is about reducing exposure to people outside your household and so limiting public gatherings, limiting the number of people who can be in a public space. Will help us do the work we need to do to flatten the curve.
We're hearing that this emergency rule, Senator Steve Nass yesterday said, you're not following the law. You're breaking the law. Will you put your emergency rule through the rulemaking process?
Mm-hmm. So we wrote the order within the scope of the Supreme Court ruling in May. I think it's really important for us to work together with our colleagues in the legislature to help protect the people of the state, to help stop the spread, to do things like organize together to ask the federal governments of Congress to provide more money for this response, to do the kinds of things that model good hygiene, mask wearing, limiting our interactions with others, the social distancing. We can all do those things together, but we are certainly anxious to work with the legislature to do what we can to protect the people of this state.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Have a good one.
You too. Andrea Palm, Secretary Designee of the Department of Health Services. Coming up, from Uber to Airbnb, we take a look at how the pandemic has changed the gig economy. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans. This morning at 8, the Senate Judiciary Committee will resume hearings for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Senators are scheduled to begin questioning the nominee. You can hear live NPR coverage starting at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio's NPR News and Music Network and at WPR.org. Right now, we're checking in on the gig economy as millions of permanent full-time jobs just evaporate from our economy this year. Freelancing has become a means of survival. Research firm Edelman Intelligence surveyed thousands of freelancers over the summer and found independent work is booming. 59 million Americans who freelanced in the past year now generate more than $1 trillion in annual earnings. That's up 22% from last year. Are you a temp worker or in the gig economy? How are you generating business for yourself? We're at 800-642-1234. Arun Sundararajan is the Harold Price Professor of Entrepreneurship and Professor of Technology, Operations, and Statistics at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy. Arun, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Delighted to be joining again, Kate.
Well, give us your top-level observations now of the gig economy, the freelance, the short-term contract work. What are you seeing out there?
Well, you know, historically, during an economic downturn, the gig economy becomes increasingly important as people either have to supplement their full-time income or do not have a full-time income. They turn to these days, platform-based gig work, but in the past, just, you know, sort of jobs on the side. I think the pandemic is accelerating a trend that we've been seeing play out for the last 20 years, which is a steady increase in the fraction of the workforce that depends in part or in full on some arrangement of work that is not employment. You know, it could be freelance work, it could be running your small business, it could be platform work in order to make ends meet. And the pandemic is underscoring just how dependent the economy has become on this way of earning a living for a lot of the American workforce.
And explain for us what platform work would be.
Well, this would be work that you do or money that you earn where there's a digital platform of some kind, like a platform like Airbnb, a platform like Uber, like Etsy, where you are connecting with your customers or you are getting the work not directly from someone in the physical world, but by advertising yourself on a digital platform, by creating a small business on a digital platform and reaching your customers that way.
So, you know, some aspects of the sharing economy are doing better than others, but a lot of this comes down to trust. Do we trust getting into that Uber? Do we trust going to that Airbnb? What do you make of that? Can we change that going forward?
Well, I think we had made a lot of progress over the last 10 years in getting people more and more comfortable to the right level on the consumer side with participating in the platform economy, in the sharing economy. What I mean by this is that when you stay in an Airbnb, you are actually staying in a place that a host on Airbnb, an individual running a tiny business on Airbnb, is the actual business that you're interacting with, and Airbnb is more of the intermediary. Airbnb does a ton of things to try and make this more seamless, but it's different from, you know, checking into a hotel and you know, booking your stay directly with the business. The role of the business is a little different when you've got platform mediated business. And so, you know, what ends up happening is that over time, consumers understand the risks. They also understand who's taking what responsibility, and they become smart consumers. I think what the pandemic has done has upended across the board the extent to which we can trust things that are familiar, right? You know, you speak to people who are starting to travel again, and, you know, they worry about that Airbnb, but they probably worry more about that hotel room now. This is not something that you ever had a trust problem with. And so in many ways, I think the sharing economy platforms have a distinct advantage now because they've spent all these years figuring out how to build trust in unfamiliar experiences. And now we have, you know, a set of familiar experiences that have suddenly become unfamiliar. And so the platforms like Uber and Lyft on the ride sharing side, you know, Airbnb on the accommodation side, have the capabilities necessary to be able to give people the information they need to make sort of smart choices.
Arun, you were saying back in May that the failure rate of businesses is going to go up dramatically in the months to come. Is that bearing out?
I believe so. I think that the typical small business typically has a, you know, 6 month to 12 month, in some cases, 18 month runway. As revenue drops and as business slows, most small businesses have a way of holding on, even though they're not making as money as they need to break even. There are some resources, there are some reserves, you sort of tap into your savings because you want to keep the business alive. But, you know, about a year into a recession is when you start to see the small business failure rate tick up. And I'm deeply worried that the kind of failure rates that we're going to start seeing next year are going to be higher than anything we've seen in the past, because the magnitude of what's being hit, I mean, the magnitude with which we're being hit by this new recession is just sort of it's unprecedented, as we know. I think what the businesses that are particularly vulnerable are the ones who rely very extensively on physical world interaction. And so a restaurant that has not made the transition to also selling through a platform like Uber Eats or DoorDash, one of the delivery options, Seamless, that restaurant is far more vulnerable than one that has realized that they can make some money and generate some business digitally. I think the same is true for small stores, for service businesses. And so my advice to small businesses now is, if you haven't already come up with a digital strategy to survive, and, you know, you don't have to create your own website or build your own app. It's a question of finding the right platform to connect with and being creative. It's really essential right now that small businesses think about digital as a critical source of resilience for them.
We're talking with Arun Sundararajan, who's a business professor at NYU, and he studies how digital technologies transform business, government, our society. He's telling us how the gig economy is faring amid COVID. Are you a freelancer? What do you do? How is business? When did you turn to freelancing? How is it going? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. So, Arun, as our economy sheds more and more permanent full-time workers and more people turn to independent contract freelancing, hanging out their shingle-type work, can our economy support all that independent work? Is there enough work to go around to be a freelancer?
I believe that there is enough work to go around because, you know, fundamentally, whether, you know, a lot of work that used to be done as full-time work will now be refashioned as freelance work. If you think about, take the travel and short-term accommodation, you know, the hotel sector as an example. As more and more people started to stay in Airbnbs, yes, travel went up, but some people started substituting away from hotels. And so the number of full-time jobs available in hotels has probably gone down, but the amount of work being done to accommodate people has actually gone up because so many more people were traveling before the pandemic and staying at Airbnbs. It's just that the way that this work is organized isn't as full-time employment, it's as small business ownership or freelance work. But you brought up supporting these workers, and I think that leads to a much more critical challenge that the country faces, which is that, you know, over the course of the 20th century, we created our social safety net to support full-time work. You know, we've attached benefits to full-time employment. The employer plays a big role in funding, you know, health insurance, workplace insurance, retirement planning, even, you know, the expectation of getting the same amount of money every month through a salary, sort of income stability. And I think it's really, really critical that we start to think very hard about how we're going to create a funding model for a 21st century safety net that isn't just aimed at people who have a full-time job, but is aimed at people who are working in some non-employment work arrangement. Because we've got a real gap here in society where if you are a freelance worker and you want benefits, there are very few avenues to you. A lot of people just end up, a lot of married couples end up saying, well, one of us will work full-time and get the benefits and the other one can be a freelancer. But, you know, that's hardly the solution we want for an advanced economy like ours. We need to come up with a way to offer benefits, not just to full-time workers, but to everybody.
We saw that a little bit come out in the CARES Act funding as well, legitimizing that you need to build a safety net for a variety of forms of work.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that was a big step forward, extending unemployment benefits to people who were not full-time employees, but also gig workers. But, you know, look at the way the benefit is named, right? I mean, it's called unemployment insurance. And so it underscores the fact that government's default assumption is that work equals employment. And so lack of work equals unemployment. And the reality is that so much work doesn't come in the form of employment. It comes in the form of freelance work and gig work. And so I'm hoping that, you know, there has been some progress made over the last few years at the state level and to some extent at the federal level. The Labor Department recently announced that it was trying to figure out how to rethink its guidelines for putting people in the full-time employee bucket versus the freelance bucket. But
let's pause there because we're talking about the gig economy with business professor Arun Sundararajan. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on how COVID-19 has changed the world of freelancing. Self-employment is up. There was an uptick in people who started freelancing for the first time at the onset of the pandemic, but social distancing also threw a curveball at the gig economy. Can we trust each other to go back to the sharing economy? Are you an independent contractor working on a gig-by-gig basis? How is it going? We have NYU business professor Arun Sundararajan for 10 more minutes. Arun, you were talking there about the Labor Department proposing a new rule that would make it easier for companies to designate workers as independent contractors. Why is that important?
Well, I think that there's a lot of confusion right now around what kind of arrangement with a company constitutes full-time employment and what kind of arrangement constitutes independent work. And this is underscored by the battles that Uber has been fighting with a number of different state governments most recently with California, about whether their drivers should be thought of as full-time employees or whether they should be thought of as contractors. And the challenge comes from us having created these definitions at a time when, you know, it was simpler. You know, when you worked, you were a full-time employee. And so, for example, economic dependence, the fact, the idea that you depend on a large company to earn your living is part of the definition. But in a platform world, this kind of dependence on a large company takes many forms, right? I mean, most small businesses depend on Google to get their business because, you know, their ranking in the search results makes a big difference in how much business they get. They depend on Google for advertising. An Airbnb host depends on Airbnb to get their business. eBay seller depends on eBay. An Uber driver depends on Uber. And we're sort of realizing that the idea of, for example, dependence on a company is not the same as full-time employment. And so I think that this is a move to try and clarify what exactly is a full-time employee. And, you know, I'm hoping the next step will be to solve the real problem, which is that for those people who aren't full-time employees, how do we make sure that we give them an adequate social safety net? Because it's critical that, you know, we extend these benefits and protections to people who don't have this full-time work arrangement. And as you pointed out, Kate, the number of people who have exited full-time arrangements and are making money in other ways has just increased during the pandemic.
What do you see as the ripple effect of Proposition 22 in California? What could that have on the rest of the country?
Well, I think it depends on how the ballot initiative goes. Mm-hmm. You know, just to sort of set some background, California passed a law last year that, among other things, mandates that Uber drivers and people who deliver for platforms like Seamless and DoorDash should be classified as full-time employees. And not surprisingly, the platforms are sort of pushing back. And one of the ways in which they're pushing back is they've put a initiative on the ballot, Proposition 22 in November, on which, like, you know, the state of California is going to vote whether or not to go ahead with this these new rules or whether to create a different funding mechanism for benefits for people who are not full-time employees. And so I like Proposition 22 in part because it's a start, you know, it's a way of saying, let's put into law a mechanism for funding the benefits, the protections, the unemployment insurance, the...
it gives, you know, framework and structure.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a starting point and then we can build from there. And the reason why I think it's important is because, you know, today it's Uber drivers and people who are delivering food to you. But in 10 years, it's going to be accountants. It's going to be lawyers. It's going to be management consultants, maybe even professors who are in this gray area between full-time employment and independent contracting. And so more and more of the workforce is going to need some sort of way of getting their benefits funded. And I think Proposition 22 lays a stake in the ground and says, here's a way to start.
We're talking with Arun Sundararajan, who is a business professor at NYU. He's an expert on the sharing economy, the rise of it. We're checking in with him on how independent contractors and freelancers are doing amid COVID and taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Arun, what did the move to doing full-time work, all your work from home, how has that affected how companies consider these jobs that can be done fully from home?
Well, Kate, I think what's happening is that a number of companies are thinking about whether they need to have this work done as full-time employment. Pre-pandemic and for many decades, the default idea of working in a company was that you go there, you spend all day like in your office or with a team on the factory floor, like, you know, sort of co-located with other people doing the same work. And there are lots of efficiencies from that. It makes communication easier, it makes standardization easier. But because of the pandemic, a number of companies have been forced to rethink how they do work while people are not in the office. And so there's been a ton of creativity unleashed within these companies to rethink how they arrange their work and you know, how they actually get stuff done while people are not in the office. And what I think is going to happen is that the natural next step for companies is to say, well, you know, if we can get all our work done without people being physically in the office, maybe we can shift some of this work to people who we contract with through platforms, because they don't have to be in the office anyway. It's not necessary that they be in the same city where the work is being done. They can do it remotely. So why do they have to be full-time employees at all? I also think it's going to accelerate automation because, you know, a big barrier to automation for companies or for sort of converting work that used to be done by humans to some sort of machine form of work is that you have to sort of rethink how you do the work before you can automate.
Mm-hmm.
But since companies have been forced again to go through 6 months of thinking about rethinking how they do the work, I think we could also see a speeding up of AI and robotics-based automation.
It just sounds almost like a revolution happening in the business and economy. I'm wondering, as you watch the trajectory of the surge, and here in Wisconsin, we're undergoing a great surge of COVID, how might the future of the gig economy look post-pandemic? What might it be like?
Well, it depends on the sector of the gig economy, but broadly, I think the gig economy is going to be a far more central part of the world of work. And, you know, making your money through some way other than full-time employment is going to be an increasingly important way in which we get by. Certain sectors of the new gig economy, and, you know, Uber always is front and center when people think of the gig economy because it's grown so dramatically over the last 10 years and millions of Americans earn all or part of their income by driving for Uber. We may see some drops in the demand for Uber, but we might see a rise as well because a lot of people may shy away from, you know, taking the bus or taking the train and instead want to have some control over their space. And so if Uber sort of builds our trust in the safety of their space, I can see a shift towards it. But the really important change, Kate, again, is that, you know, more and more people who used to be full-time employees are now going to be making all or part of their income through the gig economy.
And very quickly, Arun, do you see that rugged individualism, that entrepreneurship, that ability of people to say, you know what, I can go it alone?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's, you know, there hasn't been a time in the last 20 years where I've felt that that is more important and a greater source of strength. I think what's particularly important today is that there are so many more opportunities for transforming that individualism into an actual small business.
Mm.
You don't actually have to hang up a shingle or get a big loan and start your own small business. You can, on your own, you can do it with the help of a platform. Because there are so many digital platforms that can transform that entrepreneurial spirit into some version of a small business. And so I think the future is certainly, for the United States, is certainly sort of an entrepreneurial one.
Arun, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Arun Sundararajan, a professor at NYU's Stern School of Business. Just ahead, we talk with the University of Georgia School of Law professor. This is the Ideas Network.